crampons in your bag, ice axe in your hand. After days hunched over your maps and weeks of meticulous planning, you leave the safety of the hut and head up. Your tent bends inwards from the power of the wind, and all you can do is wait for the storm to pass. You've traversed ridges, cols and glaciers, and now you've reached the summit. Peaks stretch across the horizon, and you finally feel at home. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. I'm Jerry Broughton. In this podcast, we hear from those who live, love and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the stories that lie behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Our guest today embodies the spirit of adventure and endurance, both physical and emotional. Cecilia Skoog is the only woman in the world to have reached the seven summits and the two poles. The seven summits are the seven tallest mountains on each of the seven traditional continents. That means Cecilia has not only climbed Everest, but has also skied to the North and South Poles. She achieved all of this by the time she was just 31 years old. But tragically, in 2008, Cecilia was involved in the K2 disaster. She narrowly escaped with her life, while 11 other climbers died, including her husband and climbing partner, Rolf Barr. Since then, Cecilia has endured the challenges of being a young widow, but has continued a life outdoors, showing an abiding passion for the mountains. You're joining us from Oslo, Norway, where you live. Hello, Cecilia. Welcome to What's Your Map? And tell me, I think I can see the map in front of you. I have a map here. What do you have to share with us today?
Today I have, to me, a very special map. It's a map of Jotunheimen. I guess in English that means the home of the giants or trolls. Mm. I can understand why they named it that many, many years ago. I don't know exactly when. Maybe it was like Norse mythology. But standing there with all these big giants, these rough mountains around you, it's easy to understand that they thought that there were, this was like the home of the trolls.
Where are we exactly in Norway? Can you just give us a sense of the region and where we are?
We are in the middle of Norway. It's the steepest part of Norway, the steepest mountains. It's the wildest area, I would like to say. And the part where we're going to talk about today is the western part of Jotunheimen.
And this map, I love this map because it takes me back to school days. It's a standard, what we might call here in the UK, an ordnance survey map. It's full of trig points and contour lines. What is the scale of this map, Cecilia? Do we know?
This is the normal hiking map scale, which is 1 to 50,000. And that's a good scale to, then you can see the rivers, the lakes, you can see kind of, it becomes kind of three-dimensional with the contour lines. You can see the steepness. And it's easy to plan like a day trip from this map.
Seriously, I mean, you can see that, can't you? The contour lines converging on the area, yeah, that you're going to talk to us about. It's made by a company called Nordic Maps. When would you then be using this map? You said it's a hiking map. This is very much a map for, you know, people who are hiking, you know, mountaineering. What kind of use would it have?
It's a map you use for planning the trip. So to me, most of the time, it's a big part of my, well, all my journeys is to sit there and plan the trip, look at the map, picturing it. And with this kind of topographic map, you can plan for the trip. And also, you can also plan like an escape if your plan A doesn't work, because there are cabins. You can look for mountain ridges, and you can also plan for where to drop off the mountain with skis, because you can see where kind of, in Norwegian, it's called skovel. It's where snow builds up. And so you can look at the map and find the best ways down on skis, where the best snow will be.
So I'm really interested in this, because we have a lot of people who come on the podcast and talk about, you know, a map that they love and that they're engaged with. But this map for you is absolutely vital to how you really survive in this area, isn't it? I'm just curious about how much more invested in the map you are as somebody who is hiking or mountaineering than other people who might just be trying to get from A to B.
Yeah, I'm invested, and most of it, because I've been here so many times, I use the map mostly when I'm before the trip. I don't always actually bring this paper map to the mountains, because I've been there so many times. But I do have, yeah, sometimes I do. But it's like to one of these mountains, the highest mountains. I've been now every month during a whole year. And I've been, I don't know how many times I've been to this mountain. So I know it's like, I know it's like my backyard, kind of.
It's what we say here, like the back of your hand. So you don't need the map. When you're there, you don't take the map. You don't need it.
Looking at the map, to me, it's more like a diary. When I look at it now, it's like, oh, that's when I was freezing. So I remember trips looking at it.
That's lovely. Does your map have you got little notes on it and annotations? Do you mark it? Is it really dog-eared and sort of old and crusty?
I have a few copies of this map. The one I have in my cabin, that looks different, because that's where I normally go to this mountain area from. Right. I start from the cabin, which is like 40 minutes away from Jotunheimen.
Take me into this area and give me a sense, because obviously we know what a map does. A map takes a three-dimensional, you know, landscape, which you amazingly confront and move through, but this is flat. Give me a three-dimensional journey into this map.
Yeah, the name is Hurungane.
Hurungane.
Hurungane. It's like, try to be Irish, and then yes, you can. It's probably right.
Right.
Hurungane.
Hurungane.
And it's not a word that most Norwegians would understand. It's really old name, but I think it means something like the rough ones. This is a rough mountain range. There are so many ridges, steep and narrow mountain ridges, and they go from north to south, and even from east to west. And they are really beautiful, and it's perfect to kind of climb and hike on them, but you do have to bring a rope on most of them. Maybe there are some rappels, maybe you have to do a little bit of climbing, but it's really easy. It's not hard climbing, but it's so nice. And when you're on the mountain ridge like this, you have a view from all the directions, and then you look down to beautiful glaciers and deep valleys. So it's a very, it's a rough and hard and wild area, but it's also very peaceful. And in the summer, it's green in the valley, and the green and the blue glaciers and small flowers just here and there. It's so beautiful.
Because you've got some serious heights here. I can see with the contour lines and the numbers, you've got 2056, 2018 in the
and
east
the highest,
there.
Yeah.
Pick out some places for me, just to give me a sense of where you've been and what these places look like.
Do you see to the west?
Yeah.
Northern, like where you see that the route 20 between 19 and 20 north. There is a place called Turtagre. It's a hotel. It's open only 1 month a year, and it's a small hotel, and that's where all the dream starts. That's where the climbers come, and they have all these ambitions.
Right.
And then they come there and they look up to these mountains, and then it's like,
oh amazing.
Okay. So that's, and then you become humble just there.
And that's your jumping off point. So that's from where you really set off from. Okay, great. And then how long from that point would you be walking? Give me a sense of what your route and your itinerary would be, and how long would this take to get to some of these peaks?
Yeah. So if you hike along the Skagastølsdalen, you can hike from there, from Turtagre, up to, you see this water that's called Skagastølsvatnet?
Yep.
Yeah, it's 1,370 meter above sea level. So then you've hiked 400 meters from, hide meters from the hotel. And then you continue up, and then you walk across the glacier. And there is a little cabin around. Do you see that it's, I don't know what it's called in your map, but here it's called the Tindeklubbhytta, just before that lake, like 500 meters before that lake, north of the lake. It's called maybe Skagastølsbu on yours?
Yes, I see it. Ah, that's the cabin. So that's a cabin. So the cabin's a mark that you can stay at.
Yeah. So a lot of people stay there after they've hiked that. Especially in the winter, because the days are so short. Mm. And then you hike along the water, the Skagastølsvatnet, and then it becomes more and more, it's narrow. It narrows, and then you are in front of these wild and steep faces. These mountain faces, they are really like hard. And it's a big contrast, I think, from all these small flowers growing in this beautiful valley and then to these hard and black mountain faces. The thing is that you have winter almost at least like 10 months a year here. So you can actually ski until June. We left our skis here in June, and July, August, it's like, then it's, the snow melts, but then it starts to snow again in the end of August. So here is a lot of winter.
I can hear when you're transported there, the power emotionally for you. Why is this area so significant for you, Cecilia?
This was, when I grew up, west of this. I grew up in another mountain area, which is also very beautiful. When you asked me to pick a map, I was like, oh, probably people where I'm from, they would, I hope they don't listen to this podcast, because they would be angry at me not picking that area. But when I was 19 and I kind of grew out of that, I wanted to go to even higher mountains. So I chose to go to Jotunheimen. And this is kind of where I started climbing. And this is maybe here I developed as a climber, and I learned so much. I made so many mistakes, and I learned to be humble. And it's kind of where after having spent many years here, also working as a glacier guide here, I started to look at mountains outside Norway. So this is a playground.
So how early does the playground begin for you? When were you first drawn to mountaineering?
I was drawn to the outdoor life when I was a child, but I didn't learn about the mountaineering and the climbing and the glacier travels until I was in the end of my teens.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Did you ski?
But,
you skied.
Yeah. It's all Norwegian kids ski.
Yeah, exactly. Before you walk. And so what? That's interesting because I would have assumed from what I know a bit of the story that it would be much younger. Why relatively late? I guess for somebody who was so defined by this area and the mountains.
Yeah, this was kind of this area is in the middle of Jotunheimen, and it's not a place where you just pass if you go. If I went to Oslo, for example, so I did hike on mountains, but climbing I didn't start until I was in the end of my teens because I had to meet people that were climbers, and that happened, in my late teens, actually.
Yeah, but how do you get, Celia, how do you get from mountaineering in this little region of the map that we show you that you're climbing by the late, your late 20s, very early 30s, you're climbing the highest mountains, the seven peaks in the world. How does that, give me a sense of that journey. How do you go so quickly, move so quickly? If you started in your late teens, so you've got a 10-year period where you're suddenly exploding in terms of your mountaineering. What's the story? Tell me.
Yeah. Well, I went to school in Oslo and I became a nurse, but I never had time to practice that much because I had to be in the mountains all summer working as a glacier guide. I did that for 5 years from maybe I was 18, 19 till 23. And the trips became longer and longer, and the mountains just gradually higher and higher. And most of those years, I spent more than 200 nights in a tent. And when spending that much time in the outdoors and in mountains and in wild places, you learn quickly.
What do you learn? You learn the actual practicalities of mountaineering, I guess, which we can talk about. But more broadly, I guess, emotionally, what are you learning? What is it that's so powerful for you emotively? And what do you learn as a person by being in those kind of very extreme environments?
It's like you say, like skiing, actually skiing and climbing sometimes is the easiest part of the trips. But mentally, it's... It can be hard. It can be sometimes just putting up a tent when it's blowing 60 kilometers an hour and it's below 70 minus. That's the hard part. That's when you have to be prepared. That's when you need to know how to put up the tent with big gloves or mittens on your hands. And it's more like it's a journey where you, most of the time, to me anyway, I have to just love what I'm doing. I have to be present. I have to not miss home too much because then the journey will be not the adventure I want to be on. I just want to feel like I'm on the right place and this is the only place I would like to be right now. Most of the time, it has to be like this. And when it feels like home.
Are you compelled to do this? So if you couldn't do it, would that be an absolute devastating loss to you? Or is there a sense in which it is something you do? You know, is there a sense in which it defines you?
You mean to go outdoors?
Yeah.
I think because I have known this for most of my life now, I would miss if I don't have to go to wild places like Antarctica or Arctic. I don't have to climb the highest mountains. I just need to go outdoors and I just need to have some quiet space and to be able to think my thoughts all the way through, to have those breaks where there's not a lot of disturbance and phone calls and other things that will pull you to their direction. I need time to reload and to have quiet. And also I think I just need to plan this, to be looking forward to it and kind of spread my wings, and then I feel alive, and I can go back and I'm be a mother, and because I know what it does for me and to me, it's I need some of it, but it doesn't have to be crazy.
Yeah.
I find Cecilia's connection to Jotunheimer so moving. But before we continue to delve further into her mountaineering life, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping the cosmos to following songlines, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest or story from this series, or the next. Now back to Cecilia's story of life in the mountains. I do want to ask you, without dwelling a long time on the K2 disaster in 2008, but I do want to ask you about how your relationship with the mountains changed after what happened, especially, I guess, after what you were just saying, that need to find a space of, I don't know, I guess I'd call it sanctuary, maybe, of peace. And I wondered what you've done since that terrible moment. To recalibrate, I guess, the relationship, because you are now traveling your mountaineering again. How has that shifted for you?
After Rolf was lost on K2, I came back and we had spent so much time together, intense. We had shared so many dreams and passion. And suddenly he wasn't there anymore. And we thought also that we would share the future. So that was so difficult to, how can I find joy again being out there without him? Who am I without him? We've shared the same dreams for like 6 years. So I didn't know then when I came back that I would ever sleep in a tent again. But I did find that I had to go outside to breathe after the accident. Mm. So I went to just the beaches around outside where we lived, just to have like a tall and open sky where I could find like easier to breathe and just to have those waves. I could count the waves, and I didn't know anything about the future, but I did know that the next wave will hit the beach somewhere. And that was kind of the perspective I needed.
And then what about bigger trips? I believe you went skiing with friends across Greenland, and that was also a moment that sort of shifted things somewhat for you.
Yeah, after maybe 6-7 months, I was sitting there in the sand dunes with the two of my friends, and they were sitting next to me. I was in the middle. And I just remember I wanted that moment to last. I was like, oh, and I knew that in a little while I'm heading home alone and they are going home to their families. But I just wanted us to stay there because it was so comfortable to have two of my best friends around me. I got a picture in my head. I think maybe I should just bring these two girls to Greenland, or I just wanted to bring them into a tent where the you know, the fabric of the tent is like breathing with the wind. I was picturing us inside with a lot of sleeping bags and like comfortable after having been out all day. And so I just wanted to bring them into the night and have them next to me. So I asked if they would you like to come to ski across Greenland with me in the spring, and they just said yes. I don't think they even thought that. Was just yes, let's do that. And that was so amazing because I had a direction. It was like I had a direction and I was going somewhere with someone. And that was so, I went to bed that night with a big smile, because next day we already had a plan that we would gonna go and pull tires on the beach to practice. And we were like a team. I was with someone again. That was so meaningful.
Can I ask you, did they know how significant that was for you as a moment? Did they just roll with it and say, yeah, let's go? But did they realize that this was very powerful for you?
Well, I think they had been seeing me with this pain and this grief for so long. And suddenly maybe they saw some light in my eyes when I spoke about this. And when I was like picturing a day in Greenland, because I'd worked as a guide there many times before this trip. So I was drawing this adventure for them, like in my head. And I think that was the first time they saw me like this in, yeah, since the accident. So I think they were just, yes, let's do it. And
great.
And I got a whole month free from the work and their family. Yeah. And that was amazing. It's a gift.
And you have to tell me that what you then did is got all your maps out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But a map of Greenland, you
yes,
can
of
just
course.
Take a,
yes, great. Yeah, I love that. When you're when you're next on, you can bring the Greenland map in. That we'll look at that.
You can just take a white piece of
yes.
paper, and that's Greenland.
That's
it's the easiest map ever.
That's brilliant. Yeah, quite easy, that one. No contour lines there.
No, well, there are contour lines, but
there are contour
very
lines,
far apart.
Now, you've got us to Greenland, which is great. Let's go international and give me a sense of both your achievements, because they are kind of extraordinary, but also literally the high points of those seven summits, and which were the kind of great moments for you? Can you give me some? I mean, we could talk about the crossing of Antarctica, amazing, that you know, the first unassisted crossing, extraordinary achievement. What for you when you look at those moments, what are the great highlights, those moments where you have those spots of time where you say, wow, I'm here? What are the great ones for you, Cecilia?
After Greenland, I didn't want to go home. I just wanted to continue. I would just wanted to find the biggest and widest spot in the world, on the continent. And you don't have to look long before you find Antarctica, if you look at the map. And so I was like, I don't want to just go to the South Pole. I want to cross the whole glacier. I want to go from one side of the one coastline to another. And when I'm at the South Pole, I'm just half my way because I want to be out the whole season. And so I wanted to continue. And I wanted to pull like the heaviest sled I ever pulled. Because that felt good to kind of, it gave me, it's a big motivation to be able to pull 240 kilos in a sled, even if you only go like, very, very small and short steps. Yeah. you go somewhere and it's like you're on your way. You have a direction. And to me, that was so comforting. And even if I didn't feel very good when I was in my home city after the accident, because it was so hard to go into the stores and buy milk because people were looking at me, and because my sorrow was very public, and so people recognized me, and I just wanted to be invisible, being in places with other people. It didn't feel good that I wasn't able to even go into a store and buy 1 liter of milk, and sometimes I went out of the store and I didn't bring anything out because I was just afraid of people. Around me. Sometimes people came up and asked me, how are you? We have been thinking about you, and they are really nice, but I didn't want to be there with them. And I wasn't there when I was going to get milk, and they dragged me back to my worst nightmare every time they stopped me or wanted to give me a hug or ask me, how did you get down from that mountain without your husband? So that was so difficult. And most of the time I was just scared of that happening. So being in Antarctica, I knew that wasn't going to happen. I was just there.
I haven't been, but I've written, you know, about the symbolism of the North Pole and the South Pole and the way in which explorers and adventurers talk about it, and that sense in which you feel that you're either in the North Pole on the top of the world, or in Antarctica, you're kind of at the bottom of the world. And if you think again about a world map, and I wonder how that did feel to you, presumably from what you've been describing. When are the moments where you step out of that, the blisters, the sledge, just the, you know, one step after another? Do you have that sense of that you're in somewhere so unbelievably extreme, sort of you're so withdrawn, you're either at the top of the world or the bottom of the world?
Well, being in Antarctica, it is, we're there and there is just so much time. Time is like endless. The sun goes around 90 degrees south, and you can decide what time of the day it is yourself, because it doesn't matter. It just goes around, and it's as light in the night as in the day. And you wake up in the morning, and your job is to go out and ski, and just to be present where you are, and with your thoughts and your partner. And it's so beautiful. It's like endless white, and you can see the horizon, but you never get there because the horizon is so far away. And everything you have is what's inside your head, and being the best partner. That's my task every day, and try to pull this sled. But it's so motivational, because you eat 1 kilo of food from your sled every day. Mm-hmm. So you know that in 7 days, my sled will be 7 kilos lighter. So every day it's like, yeah, you don't feel it every day, but in 2 weeks you will feel it.
Now, take me all the way back from Antarctica, back to your map that we started with. Take me to what happens now. When you go back, after all that's happened to you, I mean, just in these last few years, extraordinary achievements and extraordinary challenges that you've faced, and huge admiration for, you know, what you've done, and that you go back and you plan on this map. How have you changed, or how has the landscape changed when you go back to these places that you were telling us about at the beginning of the program? With all the travels, do you see different things in you when you're here? Do you see different things in that landscape? How do you negotiate the map that we started with now?
Well, yes, I have been back here many times since I was in my late teens. But have you ever gone into a room where you grew up, like in your school, like the playground, and suddenly you're back, and now, oh my, was it this small? Oh, the mountains are not that high. So that's a kind of the same feeling, because you've seen higher mountains. But even if I have seen higher mountains, these are still the most beautiful, I think. And it's something with... It's kind of, right now, it's a black and white world, because it's white snow and really dark and black faces and ridges. But it is not, because the sun goes up and then you have 1 hour, 1 hour and a half with this beautiful light. It turns from red and purple and all these, how do you say, pastel?
Yeah, pastel colors. Yeah,
pastel colors, and they last forever, and it's so beautiful. So even if it's like white and snowy and dark mountains, there are millions of colors, and then you have these stars. You have the stars because there are no light lighting up the sky. So there is million stars, and there is stars in the snow, and so. I see all that. I see all these small details. I see the high mountains, and I have the same feelings of I'm looking forward to it every time. It's a good feeling inside the tummy, because you're present, and it's a good feeling in the heart, because you're there. And yeah, so this is it's like it time out from everything else.
Cecilia, thank you. I mean, it's wonderful. You've really put the heart and the emotion, as you've just said, into this map of trig points and contour lines going from, you know, the mountains of Norway to both poles and back again. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for sharing the story. And it's just been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for joining me on What's Your Map?
Thank you very much.
Cecilia's resilience is remarkable, and I loved hearing about how the magic of Greenland and the power of friendship helped her reignite her passion for adventure. I bet she's up a mountain right now. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. This has been an Oculimundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculimundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.